You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about the rise of addictive technology from our phones to our TVs and everything in between.
Right now, NASA wants to send a probe to the planet Venus, but the 800-degree Fahrenheit temperatures and sulfuric acid clouds make things a bit tricky. So scientists are working on a probe that uses some old-school technology so old that Leonardo da Vinci might be familiar with it.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to share the details of that story and more. She's a senior editor for Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us once a month to talk about science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be with you again.
So why is it so tricky to send a probe to Venus?
Well, Venus is not a place a probe would want to go. It is super good at frying circuits. I think the longest record for any machine surviving there is actually about 2 hours. It's got the temperatures that you mentioned. It's got that sulfuric acid. It's kind of a perfect storm of a place that you don't want a super high-tech instrument to be.
And what are we trying to find out by getting a probe down to the surface of Venus? What unanswered questions are we trying to get answers for?
Well, there's always knowledge for the sake of knowledge, you know. That's a great thing. But also, Venus is, in a lot of ways, kind of our twin. And we think, for example, that it's seismically active, but we really haven't been able to get good information on that because, again, we haven't been able to send a probe down that lasts for any reasonable amount of time.
So it sounds like there's a bit of a blast from the past in terms of the technology that's used because of the particulars of the climate at Venus that we're talking about there. So what kind of thing will work there to get information?
Well, and I have to say, this is not actually set in stone happening yet, but the engineers at NASA came up with this terrific rover. It's called the Automaton Rover for Extreme Environments, and it's built entirely of hardened metal, and it's guided by a clockwork computer. And this is, you know, this is way, way, way back in the day. We're talking about, for example, there's a 2,000-year-old Greek clockwork computer that was used to determine eclipses, to predict eclipses. Well, it's kind of like that. It's something that, you know, Leonardo da Vinci would have been familiar with, but it is all super old school. And they came up with this project to send this rover to Venus and then actually have the data it collects engraved on a phonograph-like record. I love this, right? Holding on to your vinyl, folks. It might come in useful for science. But basically, this phonographic record would have all the data recorded onto it, and then balloons would launch from the rover up just high enough so that there's a drone that's safely flying above, and the drone would pick up the phonographic records from the balloon. This is so steampunk. I love it.
I was going to say, is this a steampunk movie script?
The drone would relay the records up to a spacecraft that would be orbiting Venus. And from there, the spacecraft would process the data and send it back to Earth. So it's like a multi-step procedure. But again, you know, it's not involving any of the super high-tech stuff that, say, the Mars Curiosity rover has.
This is all if it's not intercepted by the evil Dr. Morbando and his clockwork robots, right?
I know. It's such a wonderful, like, Jules Verne discovery story.
It doesn't sound very precise. I mean, I know it's NASA, but you're talking about balloons and sending up photographs, but this is precise enough that this drone can capture the information?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when you think about it, actually landing the Mars rover involved a balloon, and that they worked that down to just, you know, the nanosecond in terms of timing. So if I was going to give anyone a job, a scientific job involving a balloon, I would give it to NASA because they know what they're doing.
And I know you said this is a design idea, more or less. Now, is there an idea of when it could be made and sent to Venus?
Well, they're still talking about it. So it's, you know, not going to take that long to make. No, I'm kidding. It is a pretty involved thing. But, you know, it's one of those things that they're thinking of doing. And now that they have a plan that might actually work, it's definitely on the drawing board as something they want to make happen.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak right now from Discover Magazine, catching up on the latest in science news. And Gemma, another topic we're going to take a look at now is warfare and the idea of where did it come from and how finely attuned are humans or inclined are humans to warfare. What's at stake there?
Yeah, well, you know, pretty much there are two main camps that have been arguing. You could say they've been at war over warfare for a long time. Different camps of anthropologists and archaeologists. One says basically violence against each other is innate. We are hardwired for it. And the other camp says, you know, until humans started settling and building societies, building city-states, there was really no need for warfare. So warfare really grew out of the advent of agriculture and settling into city-states. And these, you know, two camps have been kind of arguing back and forth, but increasingly we're finding in the archaeological record just evidence that there were some really brutal massacres that may indicate some scale of warfare going back 10,000 years, well before agriculture really took hold.
10,000 years. Talk about some of the sites that people are looking at to find this evidence of horrific human warfare.
Sure. Well, the oldest one is a place called Nataruk, and it's in Kenya. And 10,000 years ago, it was actually the edge of this lagoon near Lake Turkana. And they found at least 27 people, men, women, children. They found remains of them, and they actually found 12 complete skeletons that were found face down in what had been the lagoon. And all of these bodies, everyone killed, just had horrific injuries that really could only be inflicted by, say, blunt trauma or being shot with an arrow. This was not a case of, you know, animals getting hold of the people. They were definitely killed by other humans. And they found that, you know, the arrowheads were made out of obsidian, which is pretty rare in the area. So they think that it might have been the people coming in brought, you know, their obsidian arrowheads, and they may have been coming in from outside in a raid or maybe a territory takeover. So now you look at the older site, but there are a number of sites in Europe, specifically in what's now Germany, that, you know, for example, 3,000 years ago, there was a massive Bronze Age battle. They think it involved up to 2,000 people. And this is at a time before agriculture in this particular area really took hold. So it's a tantalizing question. Just what does this say about when warfare arose in our species?
And what about primatology? What can that tell us about whether we're geared in that direction?
Yeah, well, you know, Richard Wrangham, he is a famous primatologist, and he kind of leans toward the violence is hardwired for humans, and he points to chimps, which are our nearest living relatives. And, you know, chimps, they kind of avoid each other in terms of they avoid another pack, whatever. But if the alpha male within that chimp family senses that there's an opportunity that maybe the other pack is weakened by, you know, maybe they don't have an alpha male, whatever, they will initiate a type of warfare. So we see it in primates. There was another study out last year where they tracked, you know, the number of interspecies or against your own species acts of violence, and they found that primates tend to be a very violent lineage. So there are all these signs. It's kind of, six of one, half dozen of another right now in terms of evidence about is it hardwired in us to be violent and warring, or are we just, you know, generally peaceful, but in certain circumstances, we will turn to violence.
We'll keep watching that. And Gemma, I want to wrap up. I know we've got snow in Wisconsin today, but let's talk about rain. You wrote about that rainy season coming up, and we had some freakish winter rain not that long ago, and you shared some fun facts about rain. What were some of the fun things you learned?
Well, I think my favorite is the saying, raining cats and dogs. You know, I think we think of that as kind of a modern thing, but it actually shows up in the English language in the mid-17th century, and they think it may be a corruption of an old English word for waterfall called catadupe. And I guess if you say catadupe fast, it sounds kind of like cats and dogs. And they think that may be where it came from. Another fact I absolutely love, Earth is not the only place where it rains. Saturn's moon Titan has rain made of methane. That's no fun. And they think Saturn and Jupiter both have a type of helium rain, which I don't know, no word on if it makes your voice sound funny. But it's, you know, certainly you want a very good umbrella on any of those planets or moons.
Is it true that the methane rain stays mainly on the plane?
Yeah. I think so.
And Gemma, real quick as we wrap up, you also wrote about one of my favorite words, petrichor, and the science behind that. That's the smell that comes up kind of from the ground or the pavement after it rains.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was just recently that they found that the smell called petrichor is actually the result of geosmin, all these great words to play Scrabble with, right? And that's a byproduct of soil bacteria. It actually, the average raindrop hits the surface with enough force to trap air bubbles right where it hits. And then the bubbles then rise and pop, and that releases aerosols, including geosmin.
Huh. All right, we'll look forward to that smell when it warms up a little. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to share some of the coolest science news.
Coming up after the news, can we be addicted to our technology? We'll look at that question and why it can be so hard to put down the phone or the remote control. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.